Well, good afternoon, everybody. Kind of a weird week. We are officially kind of moved into our place. We spent our first night there last night. But needless to say, boxes are packed. My Bible is packed. All of my Bibles are still packed. You can't get to them. Computer, I was able to use it, but we couldn't print. So I wrote notes. And I actually have my Bible on here that I'm using today. So it's we're making this work, but it's definitely major league improvision. If it ends up being a very good message, give my wife credit for it. She's the one that came up with the idea. If it ends up falling flat on my face, on its face, blame me. So that way she gets the credit for it. So often when we talk about people in Scripture, it seems like the focus is on the men of the Bible. But yet there are many women in the Bible that have done great things. And I think at times we need to put a little bit of a focus on the women of the Bible and look at what they've done and their examples and how their examples can apply to us in day-to-day life. Now, according to the amount of time that it's going to take, I will get through five for sure. I may get through seven. But I'm going to be looking at somewhere between five and seven women of the Bible and some of the lessons that we can learn from them. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 11 first. There are several of the women, two that are mentioned by name and two others that are very strongly implied in Hebrews chapter 11. Starting in verse 11, it says, "By faith, Sarah herself also received strength to conceive seed, and she bore a child when she was past the age, because she judged him faithful who had promised." So it shows the reason that she realized that God had made a promise, and she knew that when God made that promise, it would come to pass. I mean, you can say things, and we'll see this as we go along, you can say things and do certain things that may make you wonder, did she really believe it? But we see here that shows that she did judge him to know that when Christ spoke to her, that it was true. Verse 12, "Therefore, from one man and him as good as dead were born as many as the stars of the sky in multitude, innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore." So we see it was through Abraham and Sarah that you have Israel come into play, and even some other nations indirectly, but Israel directly came into play because of Abraham and Sarah. Let's look at the story of Sarah for a few minutes. Go to Genesis chapter 17. And we see in the 17th chapter of Genesis, this is a chapter that's talking about circumcising, and really the focus more of the chapter is related to circumcision and the circumcision of Abraham and Ishmael and all of the men that were with Abraham at that time. And it was actually the time where his name was changed from Abram to Abraham. And in verse 15, we see that Sarah's name was changed from its original name. In verse 15, it says, "Then God said to Abraham, 'As for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name, and I will bless her, and also give you a son by her, that I will bless her. And she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of people shall be from her.'" Then Abraham, notice what he did here. Abraham fell on his face and laughed. You know, it seems in the next chapter we'll hit this, that when Sarah laughed, a bigger deal's made of it than when Abraham laughed. But Abraham, it says explicitly here, laughed and said in his heart, "Shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old?" He was 99 when this chapter started, so you figure 40 weeks after that. He would, if he wasn't 100, he was so close to 100, he may as well be. And it may not have happened immediately anyways. So He's saying, shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old, and shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child? And you think about that. I really stop and think about that, and those of you who, the women who have born children, couldn't you imagine being 90 years old and being 8 months pregnant? 9 months pregnant, having a baby? Especially when you haven't had one before, think about it as the first one that everything has to stretch and all that goes through that final stage of pregnancy when the baby's born. I mean, that would be difficult. And Abraham said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. Verse 19, then God said, no, Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant, and with his descendants after him. As for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I have blessed him and will make him faithful and multiply him exceedingly. He shall beget 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this set time next year. So that shows she wasn't going to be pregnant immediately. It was going to be shortly thereafter. So about a year after this discussion was when Isaac was born. Going to the next chapter, chapter 18. In verse 1. Then the Lord appeared to him by the terebinth tree of Mamre, as he was sitting in the tent door in the heat of the day. So he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, three men were standing by him. And when he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the ground and said, my Lord, if I have now found favor in your sight, do not pass on by your servant. Please let a little water be brought and wash your feet. Now, what does that remind you of? Passover, right? A little bit of water and wash your feet and rest yourself under the tree. Now, would Abraham have been doing this, or would it have been more likely Sarah was doing this? It doesn't say, but either one could have done this. Verse 5, and I will bring a morsel of bread that you may refresh your hearts. After that you may pass by, and as much as you have come to your servant. They said, do as you have said. So Abraham hurried into the tent of Sarah and said, quickly make ready 3 measures of fine meal, knead it, and make cakes. And then we see that Sarah does that. She doesn't know what's going on. She's doing what is requested of her. She's helping her husband. She is being a helpmeet, like what it talks about in Genesis chapter 2. So, jumping ahead to verse 9, says, then they said to him, where is Sarah your wife? So he said, here in the tent. And he said, I will certainly return to you according to the time of life, and behold, Sarah your wife shall have a son. And Sarah was listening in the tent door, which was behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, well advanced in age, and Sarah had passed the age of childbearing. Here again, you're pushing 90 years old. I don't know of anybody in modern time. I think the oldest age somebody gave birth, at least in the last 100, 150 years, was 63 or 64, something like that. So 90, you're 25 years or more past the latest, at least in what would be considered modern times, age for childbirth. Therefore, Sarah laughed within herself, saying, after I have grown old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also. Now, notice some of the attitude here. She's like, you know, I'm old now. This is going to be a lot more difficult than it would have been when I was 20 years old. But the other part of this, my Lord, look how she viewed Abraham. She viewed Abraham as her Lord, as a helper, as a partner, but also the person that is over him, over her, in the relationship. Verse 13, and the Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh, saying, surely I shall bear a child since I am old? Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son. Now, we see it says in verse 12, it says Sarah laughed within herself. there were times, and I think we all understand that, we're not necessarily rolling on the floor laughing or anything like that, but we just get kind of a little bit of a chuckle and we keep it to ourselves. So I kind of visualize this as that type of situation where she literally was, it was maybe a very soft chuckle, but it was really being kept to herself. And verse 15, Sarah denies it, saying, I did not laugh, for she was afraid. So she said that because she was afraid. And he said, and this would be Christ, Jesus, no, but you did laugh. And then after that, they went, Abraham and them went and talked, and this is when Sodom and Gomorrah came on the scene and what happened in the ensuing chapter. Genesis chapter 21. I find with that the reaction of Christ toward Sarah was a lot stronger, I felt, than it was toward Abraham. And I can't explain a reason. I can't think of a good reason for it, but just for some reason, he laughed and it didn't seem to quite have the same response as it did with Sarah. But in chapter 21, we see the birth. So this is about a year later. And the Lord visited Sarah, as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken, for Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age, at the set time of which God had spoken to him. And Abraham called the name of his son which was born to him, who Sarah bore to him, Isaac. Then Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, which was, like I said, what was key in chapter 17, and then the conversation rolled to Sarah. In verse 5, now Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him, and Sarah said, and this is really interesting, I think, that she makes this comment. She says, God has made me laugh. Now, that goes back to chapter 18 where she laughed and he confronted her with it, where God has made me laugh and all who hear will laugh with me. She also said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? For I have borne him a son in his old age. Now I want you to notice a theme to some point, and there's one or two exceptions to this, throughout this, that afterwards you see that there's a comment made or a song or a prophecy, if I get through everybody, that is almost like a prophecy of thanks to God for allowing this to happen. In this case, allowing her to become pregnant and having a son, Isaac. The next example we look at goes back to Hebrews chapter 11, verse 31. And in Hebrews 11, verse 31, it says, by faith the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe when she had received the spies with peace. So the next one we're going to look at today is Rahab. She is the only other one that's explicitly named in Hebrews 11 as a woman of faith. But it's interesting that somebody who is a Canaanite is named as a woman of faith. Let's look at why. And we're going to look at this from a different perspective. I've been in this chapter a few times in the last year or so. But we're going to focus this time more on Rahab than we did on Joshua and also Jericho and the archaeology around Jericho. So we're going to focus more specifically on Rahab. So Joshua chapter 2. And we'll go through pretty well all of this chapter. We may skip a few verses for time. In the first verse, it says, now Joshua the son of Nun sent up two men from Acacia Grove to spy secretly, saying, go view the land, especially Jericho. So they went and came to the house of a harlot named Rahab and lodged there. Now, one thing, there's some discussion about this word harlot, that it was more like she was an innkeeper than what we view as a harlot. But she owned this inn, and that's where the men were going to stay. And it was on the outer wall, as about several weeks ago in the sermon, it was on the outer wall, so it was in the poorer part of Jericho. And we'll see as we go along what she did to help the people. Verse 2, it was told to the king of Jericho, saying, "Behold, men have come here tonight from the children of Israel to search out the country." So the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, "Bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the country." Then the woman took the two men and hid them. Now, I think she knew who they were, needless to say, because she's in this situation. She's not wanting to do anything to them to hurt them, which the king of the city would probably have killed them. So she took them and hid them and said, "Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from." Did she know where they were from? She says she didn't. I think she did, if you really look at it, because she hid them because she didn't want the king thinking that they were there. So a lie in that situation to me, but it's, maybe I'm viewing it from a wrong perspective, but to me it looks like she's lying to try to save the men. And you look at it too, she's a Canaanite. She's just really learning some things. She's in the very early stages of, if you want to look at the term conversion, the way that you would convert in those days. Verse 5, and it happened as the gate was being shut, and this is what she said, when it was dark, the men went out. Where the men went, I do not know. Pursue quickly, for you may overtake them. But she brought them up to the roof and hidden them with stalks of flax, which she had laid in order on the roof. Then the men pursued them by the road to the Jordan, to the fords. And there again, that's talking about, they had cars back then, the fords of Jordan. So, okay, lots of groans. Nick, you should have expected me to throw that one out there. It's too wide open. It's just like each one with their own accord, you know. So, and then she went up in verse 8, before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and men, "I know that the Lord has given you the land." She apparently knew about what happened in Egypt. She knew that they had been walking in the wilderness for 40 years and that they had crossed over. She knew those things. Or in this case, about to cross over. They had not crossed over yet. That's the next chapter. "That the terror of you have fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. As soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Neither did any more courage in anyone because of you, for the Lord your God..." Notice what she says here, and this is why she's in the faith chapter. "For the Lord your God, he is God above and on earth beneath." So he recognized God as God, not the Canaanite gods that she probably had been worshiping up to that point, but she recognized God as God. "Now therefore, I beg you, swear to me by the Lord." So she's now saying, "In the name of God, please do this. Since I have shown you kindness, that you also show kindness to my father's house and give me a true token. And spare my father, my mother, my brothers, my sisters, and all that they have, and deliver our lives from death." So the men answered her, "Our lives for yours. If none of you tell this business of ours, and it shall be when the Lord has given us the land, that we will deal kindly and truly with you." And then she let them down through a rope, and she set up a series of things after that. Verse 17, men said to her, "We will be blameless of this oath of yours which you have made us swear. Unless we come into the land, you bind this line of scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down, and unless you bring your father, your mother, your brothers, and all your father's household to your own house. So it shall be that whoever goes outside the doors of your house into the street, his blood shall be on his own head. And we will be guiltless." What does that sound like? Passover. Now, we know that all of this was happening close to Passover time. So there can be a subtle indication of Passover in this. And whoever is with you in the house, his blood shall be on our heads if a hand is laid on him. And if you tell this business of ours, then we will be free from your oath. So she had to stay quiet. She couldn't sit there and, oh, we're going to be safe, and go blabbing it around the neighborhood. And she said, according to your words, so be it. And she sent them away, and they departed, and she bound the scarlet cord in the window. Now that takes a certain amount of faith, too. And let's think about the reason for this. Here you've got this scarlet cord hanging out your window. I doubt anybody else in the neighborhood in that area had a scarlet cord or any type of cord hanging out their window. And she left it there. Couldn't you imagine some of the questions? Why is a scarlet cord stuck out this window? And her having to try to explain that in a way that didn't give away what was going on. She had to show an extreme amount of faith to survive this approximately probably 2 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks. Let's go to Joshua 6. Joshua 6, this is when they're marching around for 6 days. They marched around 6 times, and then the 7th day, they marched around 7 times, and they were quiet. And for the kids, they weren't dropping slushies on them. Verse 16, Joshua 6, and the 7th time it happened, when the priest blew the trumpets, that Joshua said to the people, shout, for the Lord has given you the city. Now the city shall be doomed by the Lord to destruction, it and all who are in it. Only Rahab the harlot shall live, she and all who are with her in the house, because she hid the messengers that we sent. So she survived because of what she did with those messengers and hid them. Verse 18, and we'll skip down to verse 22. But Joshua had said to the 2 men who spied out the country, go into the harlot's house, and from there bring out the woman and all that she has, as you swore to her. And the young men who had been spies went in and brought out Rahab, her father, her mother, her brothers, and all that she had. So they brought out all her relatives and left them outside the camp of Israel. So she survived. And you remember in the sermon several weeks ago, they said there's a place in the wall that is still upright that they found in their excavations. And that is probably Rahab's house. It's the only place that's upright in the entire city of Jericho in that time frame from the excavation. James chapter 2. We see Rahab is used as an example, even in the New Testament, and we will see later that Sarah was also. But James 2, verse 25, likewise, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works? Now notice, this is the chapter where it talks about faith without works is dead, around verse 17, 18. You show me my faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. Likewise, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out another way? So she showed her faith by her works, by protecting those people, by doing what they said, what the spies said to her to do. And then if you even look down the road, it's thought that she married one of those 2 spies, and she's in the direct genealogy of Christ, because she's, I believe, the grandmother of Ruth, or great-grandmother of, how'd that go? It's like 2 to 3 generations before you got to Ruth, and then 2 more generations to David. So she's in that lineage because of her faith. Let's go back to Hebrews chapter 11. It'll be verse 35. We're going to look at one very specific thing here where it says, women received their dead raised to life again. There are 2 very good examples of this in Scripture. One is the widow of Zarephath, which was during Elijah, and also the Shunammite, which was Elisha. So let's go to those two. 1 Kings chapter 17. So in 1 Kings 17, we see, starting in verse 8, what had happened is there was a famine, and Elijah was fed by ravens for 2 years. And after that, they ran out of water where he was at, because he was along a brook. And so God sent him somewhere and said, verse 9, arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there. See, I've commanded a widow there to provide for you. So he arose and went to Zarephath. And when he came to the gate of the city, indeed a widow was there gathering sticks. And he called to her and said, please bring me a little water in a cup that I may drink. And as she was going to get it, he called to her and said, please bring me a morsel of bread in your hand. What she says next, really, it stuns you in a way, but people have to get to a point of no return sometimes before they do change. I don't think that's the case with this person. Verse 12, so she said, as the Lord your God lives, I do not have bread, only a handful of flour in a bin and a little oil in a jar. And see, I'm gathering a couple of sticks that I may go in and prepare it for myself and my son that we may eat it and die. This is the very last food she has. Now, let's ask a question. If you have somebody come up to you that you don't know as a prophet, and you have just a very little bit of food, and you're going to feed yourself and your son, and it's the last food that to all you know that you're ever going to have, are you going to feed the person that comes up to you and ask you to be fed first? I think it'd be safe to say I'd have a battle with that one. I mean, that one would really be a major battle for me. What Elijah said in response is, do not fear. Go and do what you have said, but make me a small cake from it first and bring it to me, and afterwards make some for yourself. So see, and afterwards your son. So you see, he's still sitting there saying, make me the cake first. The level of faith she had to have to step out and do that was phenomenal, because she's staring death in the face. Verse 14, for thus says the Lord God of Israel, the bin of flour shall not be used up, nor shall the jar of oil run dry until the day the Lord sends rain on the earth. What a promise. You're going to be fed until there's rain, until there's food. Verse 15, phenomenal example of faith. So she went away and did according to the word of Elijah, and she and he and her household ate for many days. Now, this was probably about a year and a half, because the next chapter was the prophets of Baal, and it was 3.5 years without rain. So probably about a year and a half for this. Verse 16, the bin of flour was not used up, nor did the jar of oil run dry, according to the word of the Lord which he spoke by Elijah. So we see the example of faith right there by the widow. But now she has another example coming up. Verse 17, now it happened after these things that the son of the woman who owned the house became sick, and his sickness was so serious that there was no breath left in him. So she said to Elijah, what have I to do with you, O man of God? Have you come to me to bring my sin to remembrance and to kill my son? Now, that could be interpreted as kind of questioning faith a little bit. I don't think it is. Because if you look at what Sarah said, or the way she reacted when she said, when God said, you're going to have a child. Look at how Abraham reacted when God told him Sarah is going to have a child. Look at the reaction. It's kind of like, okay, you know, this is how I view it. Okay, we've been doing this, and all of a sudden they're dead. Why? Why did he die? It's not really a questioning of faith so much. It's like, I don't see why this should have happened. And when she comes in, it's, have you come to me to bring my sin to remembrance? That's kind of like, is it something I did that caused this? That I shouldn't have done that ended up causing him to die? A little bit of guilt there, not a lack of faith, but more of a little bit of guilt. Verse 19, and he said to her, give me your son. So he took him out of her arms and carried him to the upper room where he was staying and laid him on his own bed. Then he cried out to the Lord and said, O Lord, my God. And notice this, I love this with Elijah and a few others, where they say, Lord, my God. Do we view God as our God? Do you individually view God as my God? Or is it more of a broad base? We need to view God as our God, as well as the God of everybody, as the great Almighty, but he is also our God. But he says, O Lord, my God, I pray, let this child's soul come back to him. Then the Lord heard the voice of Elijah, and the soul of the child came back to him, and he revived. And Elijah took the child and brought him down from the upper room into the house and gave him to his mother. And Elijah said, see, your son lives. The woman's response is fascinating. Now by this I know that you are a man of God, number one. I think she knew it before, with being fed for up to a year and a half at this point, just with a little bit of food that it just kept refilling and refilling and refilling. And that the word of the Lord in your mouth is the truth. Now, sometimes it takes a big miracle for somebody to really realize, okay, God is going to do what he says he's going to do. He will take care of you. And we need each and every one of us individually to keep that in mind as we go through our lives. Let's go now to 2 Kings chapter 4. Even the start of the chapter is a fantastic example of a woman having faith, the prophet's wife. The prophet died and she didn't have really any food or anything. And she was told to get jars from everybody that she knew and pour what little oil she had left into all those jars and then sell it. So her and her family went and got all the jars they could get, poured the oil in. Once they poured it in, they sold it and they had sustenance for the rest of their lives for the price that they were able to sell all that oil for. So we see a faith example there. But I want to focus more on the Shunammite woman that starts in verse 8. Now it happened one day that Elisha went to Shunem, where there was a notable woman, and she persuaded him to eat some food. So it was, as often as he passed by, he would turn in there to eat some food. So she was very hospitable. Just like going back to Sarah, she was hospitable. She made those cakes for Christ when he came and visited Abraham. And when she, at the time that she left, and I'm sure other times that she did the same thing. And she said to her husband, look now, I know that this is a holy man of God. She knew probably by reputation, but she also could just see it in him. And I know this is a holy man of God who passes by us regularly. Please let us make a small upper room on the wall and let us put a bed for him there and a table and a chair and a lampstand so it will be whenever he comes to us, he can turn in there. So she literally talked to her husband and they built an extra room just for Elisha. I mean, that's showing a very positive example of hospitality and also showing some faith. Verse 11. And it happened one day that he came there and he turned to the upper room and lay down there. Then he said to Gehazi, his servant, call the Shunammite woman. When he had called her, she stood before him. And he said to him, say now to her, look, you have been concerned for us with all this care. What can I do for you? Do you want me to speak on your behalf to the king or the commander of the army? She answered, I dwell among my own people. So he said, what then is to be done for her? And Gehazi answered, actually, she has no son and her husband is old. Well, this sounds a little bit familiar, doesn't it? Abraham and Sarah. So he said, call her. When he had called her, she stood in the doorway. Then he said, about this time next year, you shall embrace a son. Okay, that sounds vaguely familiar also, doesn't it? From the 17th chapter of Genesis. And she said, no, my Lord, man of God, do not lie to your maidservant. Look at the response. It's surprisingly similar. I mean, the one chuckled and the other one's saying, please don't lie to me about this. This is a serious matter. Verse 17, but the woman conceived and bore a son when the appointed time had come of which Elisha had told her. See, a lot of what happened there parallels Abraham and Sarah very closely. And she has the child. Now, we take this a step farther, where if you go into the 26th or 22nd chapter of Genesis, where Abraham took Isaac to be sacrificed, and that kind of leads into what's coming up now. Verse 18, and the child grew. Now it happened one day that he went out to his father, to the reapers. And he said to his father, my head, my head. So it was almost like he had some type of a tumor or he had an aneurysm and it ruptured in his brain or something like that. So he said to a servant, carry him to his mother. When he had taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat on her knees till noon and then died. So this would not have been that old at this point if he was sitting on her knees. So under 8, 9, 10 years old. Verse 21, and she went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God. Watch the process of this. This to me, when you see everything she did, the amount of faith she showed was just extreme. And we need to have that level of faith. She laid him on the bed of the man of God, shut the door upon him, went out. Then she called her husband and said, please send me one of the young men and one of the donkeys that I may run to the man of God and come back. So he said, why are you going to him today? It's neither a new moon nor the Sabbath. And she said it as well. Now, she said that knowing perfectly well that son is dead. But also, is this showing like a supreme level of confidence that child was going to be resurrected? When she tells her husband it is well, that's the way I lean. I mean, I think that she knows something's going to happen. Verse 24, then she saddled a donkey and said to her servant, drive and go forward. Do not slacken your pace for me unless I tell you. So she departed and went to the man of God at Mount Carmel. So it was when the man of God saw her afar off that he said to his servant Gehazi, look, the Shunammite woman, please run now to meet her and say to her, is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Is it well with the child? And she answered, it is well. Here again, the same answer, it is well. Like she knows something's going to happen, that child will be brought back to life. Now when she came to the man of God at the hill, she caught him by the feet, but Gehazi came near to push her away. But the man of God said, let her alone, for her soul is in deep distress, and the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me. There are times God will not tell us why something's going on until the time that you need to see it. And this became one of those cases. Because a lot of times you will find that people will know that something's going to happen before it's happened. Some of the prophets, they would know that someone was coming very specifically for a reason, and that they were going to have, that this was going to happen. But this was hidden from him. And the man of God, Elisha, said, leave her alone, for her soul is in deep distress, and the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me. So she said, did I ask a son of my Lord? Did I not say, do not deceive me? She didn't ask. He said, you will have a son in about a year. And then she comes back and says, look, you gave me the son, but She didn't say it this way, but now he's dead. Then he said to Gehazi, get yourself ready and take my staff in your hand and be on your way. If you meet anyone, do not greet him. And if anyone greets you, do not answer him. So, I mean, he was to be purely focused on getting there as fast as possible. But lay my staff on the face of the child. And the mother of the child said, as the Lord lives and not as your soul lives, I will not leave you. So he arose and followed her. I mean, she knew he could heal through God that child. Now Gehazi went on ahead of them and laid the staff on the face of the child, but there was neither voice nor hearing. Therefore he went back to meet him and told him, saying, the child is not awakened. So by this time, Elisha definitely knew what was going on. And I think he figured it out probably at the point where she made the comment to him about, essentially, you told me I'm going to have a son. And he probably was able to put one and one together very quickly at that point, that something's wrong with the son. When Elisha came into the house, there was the child lying dead on the bed. He went in, therefore, shut the door behind the two of them, and prayed to the Lord. And he went up and laid on the child and put his mouth on his mouth, his eyes on his eyes, and his hands on his hands. And he stretched himself out on the child, and the flesh of the child became warm. He returned and walked back and forth in the house, and again went up and stretched himself out on him. Then the child sneezed seven times, and the child opened his eyes. And he called Gehazi and said, call the Shunammite woman. So he called her. And when she came into him, he said, pick up your son. So she went in, fell at his feet, and bowed to the ground, and she picked up her son and went out. Now you think about that. It appeared she knew that her son would come back to life. What level of faith is that? How much faith would you have to have for that? You'd have to have a lot of faith to do that. I think I'll only have time for one more. This one should go fairly quickly. This one is not in the Hebrews, but it's one that I've always liked as an example because of what happens. 1 Samuel chapter 1. It really sets up the entire time of the starting of the kings. And what we're going to be looking at is another birth. I mean, here again, we see some themes with birth on some of these that I've covered today. So 1 Samuel chapter 1. We're going to start in verse 2. He had two wives. The name of one was Hannah, and the name of the other was Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. This man went up from a city, and his name is Elkanah. Went up from the city yearly to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. Also the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests of the Lord, were there. And whenever the time came for Elkanah to make an offering, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah, although the Lord had closed her womb. And her rival, Peninnah, also provoked her severely to make her miserable because the Lord had closed her womb. Doesn't that sound like another one back in Genesis? Leah and Rachel. Verse 8, then Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why do you weep and why do you not eat? And why is your heart grieved? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? So he's trying to console her. He knows why she's upset. So Hannah arose after they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat by the doorpost of the tabernacle of the Lord, and she was in bitterness of soul and prayed to the Lord and wept in anguish. This really bothered her, and apparently I would think maybe something really came to a head this day between her and Peninnah. Verse 11, then she made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head. Now that gets into the Nazirite vow. You didn't have to be a Nazarene to do the Nazarite vow. And I won't take the time to get into that. That's a good sermonette topic, the Nazarite vow. Verse 12, and it happened as she continued praying before the Lord that Eli watched her mouth. Now Hannah spoke only in her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore Eli thought she was drunk. So Eli said to her, how long will you be drunk? Put your wine away from you. So he's misinterpreting what's going on there. That she's mourning, she's depressed because she cannot have a child. And the other wife is sitting there and just making life miserable for her. But Hannah, verse 15, answers and said, no, my Lord, I am a woman of sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor intoxicating drink, but have poured out my soul before the Lord. Do not consider your maidservant a wicked woman, for out of the abundance of my complaint and grief I have spoken until now. Then Eli answered and said, go in peace, and the God of Israel grant your petition of which you have asked of him. Then she said, let your maidservant find favor in your sight. So the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. So we see an example here that she went and gave a very specific petition. Eli talked to her and said, go in peace, and may your petition be fulfilled. And that gave her comfort. In verse 19, they rose early in the morning and worshiped before the Lord and returned and came to the house in Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah, his wife, and the Lord remembered her. So it came to pass in the process of time that Hannah conceived and bore a son and called his name Samuel. Now, a lot happens during the time of Samuel. The kings start. Saul is king. Samuel dies while Saul is still king, but while Saul's chasing David all over the world trying to kill him. But bore a name, called his name Samuel, saying, because I have asked for him from the Lord. Now the man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer the Lord the yearly sacrifice and his vow. But Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, not until the child is weaned. So probably 2 or 3 years old at that point. Then I will take him that he may appear before the Lord and remain there forever. So Elkanah, her husband, said to her, do what seems best to you. Wait until you have weaned him. Only let the Lord establish his word. So essentially he's saying, remember, you promised this. Keep your promise. Verse 24, now when she had weaned him, she took him up with her with 3 bowls, 1 ephah of flour and a skin of wine, and brought him to the house of the Lord in Shiloh, and the child was young. Like I said, probably about 3 years old at this point. Then they slaughtered a bull and brought the child to Eli, and she said, oh, my Lord, as your soul lives, my Lord, I am the woman who stood by you here praying to the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition, which I asked of him. Therefore I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he shall be lent to the Lord. So they worshiped the Lord there. Now you think about the amount of faith she had to have and the confidence she had to have that she was going to have that child after what Eli said. She knew it would happen, and she kept her part of it. She kept her word. She brought him for a life of service. So from the time that Samuel was about 3 years old, he served God in the temple, the tabernacle at this point. Going to chapter 2. Now, here again, you notice I've said a few times that there are people that have said something and their responses after they've seen the miracle and their faith has been rewarded. This first part of chapter 2, she prayed and said, and I'm just going to hit a couple of verses. My heart rejoices in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. I smile at my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. And jumping ahead a little bit, verse 5. Latter part of verse 5, even the barren has borne 7, and she who has many children has become feeble. And what this is first part of this chapter down to about verse 11, is essentially this prayer of Hannah, giving thanks for the miracle of the birth of Samuel. Jumping down to verse 18, Verse 18 says, but Samuel ministered before the Lord even as a child, wearing a linen ephod. So, I mean, he's doing the job from the time of a little child. And that addresses the kids. You know, those of you who are younger, he's 3 years old, 4 years old, 5 years old, and he's doing whatever it is that he needs to do. He's doing the work that God set for him to do. Age is not a factor. I mean, 1 year old, 2 years old, yeah, they can't understand. But when you get up a little bit in age where you can understand, you can do things. You can be a positive part of the congregation and help and serve in various little ways. So we see that as an example for the children. But we see his mother was still involved with his life. Moreover, verse 19, his mother used to make him a little robe and bring it to him year by year when she came up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. And Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, the Lord give you descendants from this woman for the loan that was given to the Lord. Then they would go on their own way. So Eli gave a special blessing to them. And the Lord visited Hannah, verse 21, so that she conceived and bore 3 sons and 2 daughters. Meanwhile, the child Samuel grew before the Lord. These examples of faith, the 5 we've covered, and I will hit one more very quickly, just reference it. Deborah in Judges chapter 4 and chapter 5. I do want to go to one passage there, Judges 4. Well, it helps if I spell it right. K-U-D doesn't work. Verse 4, Judges 4. Now Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at the time. Now, I find this fascinating, that Deborah was judging Israel. She was a leader. And we'll see in the next verse, she wasn't just a leader, she was very highly respected. Verse 5, and she would sit under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the mountains of Ephraim. And the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. She was almost like, if you want to put it this way, a Solomon, kind of mini Solomon. They would come to her for wisdom. Excuse me. If I have a problem, how do I solve this? And she was given that gift as a part of what she did. And she was also a prophetess. Verse 6, and she sent and called for Barak, the son of Abinoam, from Kadesh in Naphtali, and said to him, has not the Lord God of Israel commanded, go and deploy troops at Mount Tabor, take with you 10,000 men of the sons of Naphtali and of the sons of Zebulun, and against you I will deploy Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, and his chariots, and his multitude at the river Kishon, and I will deliver him into your hand. So she's telling Barak that go and fight these people. Now they've got chariots. Israel doesn't have chariots. So they're at a huge disadvantage. So it was going to take a miracle for this to happen. Now one thing that's stated in verse 8 and 9, Barak said to her, if you will go with me, then I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go. So she said, I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, there will be no glory for you in the journey you are taking. For the Lord will sell Sisera into the hands of a woman. So she went to the battle. They won. Sisera was killed by a woman that he thought was his friend. In chapter 5, it's going to take me a minute to get back there. Something popped up on my phone right when I hit the button for the next chapter, and all of a sudden it went online. Well, chapter 5 is a song that they sang for the victory. So we see that Hannah, she gave a prayer. We see Sarah made a comment. We see pretty well everybody else outside of Rahab. There was a comment that was made recognizing the Almighty and recognizing what he did for them. To conclude, let's go to 1 Peter chapter 3. I'm wanting to focus on let's start in verse 1. Focus will be down toward verse 5 and 6. But wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they without a word may be won by their conduct of their wives. So you can be an example. I have seen cases where somebody was in the church and their example brought their spouse in, brought their husband in most of the cases that I've seen. And ironically, I can think of one case where they were dating, they started dating, and now he's an elder. So that happens. The example that you give can lead people to the truth. Verse 2, when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear, do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. Rather, let it be in the hidden person of the heart, with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. Now, we think about this for a minute. All of these women we talked about today had a very strong faith, and that is the hidden person that's referenced here in verse 4. They had a very strong faith. They had supreme confidence that God would do what needed to be done. Verse 5, for in this manner, in former times, the holy women who trusted in God also adorned themselves, being submissive to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are, if you do good and are not afraid with any terror. Women of this congregation, we've seen several examples of women in the Bible and their faith. And their faith is strong. And they help those who are around them. They help their family in the case of Rahab. They helped their husbands in the case of several of the others. That they, each and every one of them, had a role in their family relationship and also in their relationship with God. Have a strong faith. Have a supreme confidence. And let's recognize there are examples of other women that we can look at in Scripture that are very powerful. And we can learn many things from the women showing faith in all that they do in Scriptures.